Now we at Highland Radio, delighted to be working with the HSC as part of the Dementia Understand Together campaign, working in partnership with the Alzheimer's Society of Ireland, Age Friendly Ireland, the Dementia Services Information and Development Centre, Age and Opportunity and Healthy Ireland. And as part of that, here's a message on the issue of dementia.
When it comes to supporting people living with dementia, you might ask, is there something I can do? The answer is, actually, more than you think. 9 in 10 of us believe people living with dementia have the right to be active citizens in their communities. But sometimes they need support to stay connected and engaged. It starts with understanding that everyone with dementia has a different experience. So talk to them and their family. Ask them how they are and how you can help. Look around your community. Is it dementia inclusive? Is your local social or sports club welcoming people with dementia? Is your shop accessible and are spaces and amenities easy to use? It is often the small things that make the biggest difference. By being that one person who asks, "What can I do?" you are making that difference. For more information, visit understandtogether.ie or call the national helpline provided by the Alzheimer's Society of Ireland on free phone 1800 341 341 from the HSE.
All right, you are very welcome back to the 9 till noon show. And I'm joined, and really pleased to say, I'm joined in studio by Joe O'Donnell, who might be known to many of you out there as Joe 90. Joe, good morning to you. Thank you so much for calling up and saying hello. Yeah. Joe 90, where did that come from?
That's a long story.
Well, go on. Give us the short version.
I used to drive in lorries. I was thinking, I always drove at a very high speed. I still drive far too fast. And somebody, the XLR Joe 90 programme was big at that time, youngsters. And I got that name. And when I started the school buses, all the youngsters got the Joe 90 bit, and it just
stuck.
Really,
that was it.
Wildfire from the end after that.
So if someone says to you, Joe, you think they're talking to someone else?
Yeah, we get letters. Andrew gets letters as Mrs. 90 and Angela 90 and, you know, that type of thing. But so it stuck. I don't mind.
Yeah, good stuff.
I quite enjoy it.
As we do in life, celebrate lots of different milestones, and a particularly interesting one, an important one for you, was on the 26th of January. You celebrated a half a century off booze.
A long, long time.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
Unbelievable stuff.
The sad part about it is that nearly all the people that I started to go to meetings with are nearly all dead.
Yeah.
You know, I was 25 when I started going to meetings. And most of them are gone. There is a few left, a few around, and a few that have been there for a few years before me. Mm. But a few and far between.
Well, doing a bit of basic maths there, you're looking well on it.
Yeah, okay.
You're looking well on it on the age now. But everyone's relationship with drink is different, you know. But you and drink didn't get on from day one.
From day one, I would say I had a problem with drink. I probably had a problem with drink before I even started to drink. Mm. Just could not handle. And every time, I think the biggest problem with the drink and the way I drank was that remorse and the guilt the next day, because it never went the way I intended it to go. So I drank for probably about alcoholically for about 7 to 8 years.
Mm. So what age would you start at that, Joe?
Well, that's very difficult, because I would have been tippling a drink from maybe 10, 12 years of age. Mm. And started to drink then when I was maybe 17, alcoholically.
Yeah.
I liked it. I liked probably what I'd done, but I didn't like the effects after.
Do you think you were happy before you started drinking? Like sometimes, you know, people drink to a certain level to hide something else that's going on. Or...
Possibly. No, I think I was happy enough now, to be quite honest. I kept always this thing about drink even before I started drink. That I love the taste of it. Mm. People said they hate it. I love the taste of whiskey. I love the taste of brandy. Still do love the smell and everything else. Yeah. I just don't frequent anymore.
Yeah, it just was like mother's milk to you, like nectar to a honey.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. And I think it's interesting, you would have enjoyed drinking,
Yeah.
But it was the next day, it was the calm down.
There were no such thing as a good night out, because the next day, I thought a good night, but next day there was remorse and the guilt. For what reason? Something I didn't know. But there were guilt and remorse. Why? You know, normal people went out and had
I think a lot of people do get that, though. You know, I think if you're predisposed to caring what people think about you, or a bit of anxiety or whatever it might be, the next day after a drink, you know, lots of people are in the same boat. But at your level, though, it was acute. I mean, it was affecting your life, effectively.
Yeah, correct, yeah.
And what way did you drink, Joe? Was it weekends? Was it...
When I had money.
Simple as that.
Simple as that. I just drank when I had money. You know, even I sometimes drank when I had no money.
Mm.
You know, you always found a way to get drink. You know, there were always tick or you do something or you pay, you know how to pay it back or whatever, or you didn't pay it back.
That's interesting.
A lot of times, you know.
You don't see it quite as much now, but it would have been very common for someone to have tick behind the bar, stick it on the tab.
Yeah.
And you'd pay at the end of the month or at the end of the week, whatever. And
whenever you got money.
And the wee book in the shop as well.
Yeah.
So
somebody asked me once about when do you know you have a problem? And I believe once it's costing you more than money.
Mm.
You know, you're not getting to work, your things are not going well at home. That's when you start to need to look at your lifestyle or your drinking pattern.
And I suppose the story doesn't change to some extent. This was 50 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, a completely different culture in terms of drink. Very little probably conversation about it being a negative thing. Like, was it hard amongst you? Like, did you lose friends giving up drink? Do you know what I mean? I mean, that would still happen today, but what was it like giving up 50 years ago?
Yeah, well, I don't know, were the real friends?
Yeah.
This is the question you often... No, the most difficult part, I suppose, was to change the whole lifestyle. It was new. Went to the first meeting. I never looked back. I enjoyed what I seen. I felt, and you know, just enjoyed it, and I kept going back, kept going to meetings, and I gave me a new lifestyle, totally new lifestyle.
And we'll talk about that, but was it one particular conversation with someone that sort of started this process?
Very good friend of mine who was at the time very well known, and we drank together and drank heavily, and he happened to meet me one day. We're driving a digger up in a quarry up in the woodlands. And he arrived and he's, you know, wanted to talk about old times and whatnot. And he said he had been off the drink a year. And he said, I was in bad shape that day, very bad at shakes and whatnot. And he just said, you know, you should do something about it. He said, would you think about going? I said, no. But about a week later, I met him and I said, look, I'll have a wee look at it. And I went to a first meeting that Tuesday night and never looked back.
But there must have been something along with that conversation, or maybe there wasn't.
At that stage I was sick, sore and tired of drinking.
But you're just in your mid-20s, like. You were a young man, mid-20s.
Yeah,
like.
Yeah. I just had enough of drink because I knew it wasn't going to go well if I didn't sort it out somewhere.
Do you think people around you knew you had a problem with drink?
I don't know, in them days that people realised it was a problem with drink. You just drank too much.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't a problem, you know.
Yeah.
I remember the first meeting in Dunloe that I had an open meeting, and at the end of an AA meeting I was asked to go to it at 7:17, and at the end of the meeting all the AA members from Derry come out of that town. There were very few members in Donegal, and this lady asked at the end of the meeting, she wanted to know how was she contacted, if she knew a friend of hers who had a problem with drink, and everybody was looking at one another. Who Dunloe had the problem? Half the town was rip-roaring, you know.
Yeah, I got you.
And this pair, nobody realised. So it was a totally different scene.
But you don't, I mean, everyone's different, but a lot of the story's the same. Like, you don't just give up drink. You can't just carry on everything you were doing before except drink.
Yeah.
And is that, at these meetings, is that point made to you that this, if you're going to go in, Joe, on this, you're going to have to make some changes beyond just drinking?
Yeah, life changes. Your whole lifestyle, everything changes totally. Your attitude changes, you know, and until you change... Oh, excuse me.
No problem.
If you don't change your attitudes, I think there's a little saying or a slogan that says, nothing changes, you know.
Mm.
You don't change what you're doing in your lifestyle. And the thing about the programme of Alcoholics Anonymous is that it's about not about drinking, it's about avoiding situations. You don't go into frequent pubs, You know, early, especially early days, I go in now to different rooms. I want to go into a pub. I have no problem with that.
Yeah.
But it's not somewhere you should be frequenting.
Mm-hmm.
If you are, you know, if you're looking to get sober.
Yeah. So you stay away from temptation.
That's correct. Yeah. Right.
How difficult for you was not having drink? Do you know what I mean? Like, some people can smoke heavy and stop smoking, and it's. You know what I mean? That's not the difficult part for them. It's the habit, or it's the social, or whatever it might be. The actual addiction to the booze itself, was that tough for you to not have that?
No. The biggest problem is if you have one drink, it's never enough.
Yeah.
If you can stay away from the one drink, there's never a problem. But it's that one drink that does all the damage. You just can't, once you get started, you can't stop.
Yeah, once you're on it, you're
We're on it, you know, and everything else runs out. You're drunk and you can't keep going. But the first drink is not the first drink is the problem. You know, and if you can stay away from it, you're on the winner, like, and that's what it's about. And that's what the program does.
Mm.
And it's a big network. At that time, there weren't as many, but now there's actually 12 meetings a day.
Yeah, well, you had to go to the west, to Gwydor. You had to go travel quite a distance to your first meeting.
No, I was living in Letterkenny at that stage.
Yeah, but you had to travel quite a distance to your first meeting.
The early meetings was one in Letterkenny.
Yeah.
And there were one in Bunacranna, and sometimes it was on, sometimes it wasn't on. And then there were a few more started. Glentie started, and that was... And Sonora then started, and there were a few, you know, all around. And Falcarra, I think, is celebrating its 50th this year.
So... As I say, this is your story, but like, they say it's one day at a time. Is that how it was for you?
Yes. And sometimes an hour at a time.
But did there come a point where it wasn't a day at a time, that your life was alcohol free and you didn't think about it all the time?
Yeah, either is. The first year was difficult, but the after this year, the first year and the first hurdle over, there were celebrations, the birthdays, the Christmases, and all those things there. And then again, you can do anything today. We can't do now, but tomorrow.
Yeah.
You know, but the first year was very, very difficult, to say the least. But I managed. And at times we made it from one pub, it was like one to one pub, saying, "Oh, I'll wait and I'll go to the next." And I didn't go on. But then you didn't have mobile phones on them days.
Yeah.
You could ring one of these people. And you did eventually contact somebody that you knew in the friendship and the world.
But you had to do more of it on your own than you might have to now.
Yeah, without a doubt.
And, I mean, presumably then, you talked about the friends that probably weren't friends anymore, you know, drinking friends, bar friends or what have you. But especially, I think it would still be the case now, but even back then, as I say, only as a 25, 26-year-old, there are going to be other people that you're going to have to sort of spend less time with, because if you're trying to avoid temptation...
Yes.
There is quite a bit of sacrifice here, isn't there?
There's no doubt about that. There, you have to change. You have to change your attitude. You have to change your friends.
Did you have to avoid things like weddings and stuff?
No.
I
tried to stop and drink for years before that, but a wedding isn't that where downfall.
Yes.
You know, you got a few drinks and away you went. But no, I just seemed to manage, and I said there was always somebody near hand that was. That was off drink or any that there, and nobody ever forced me to take a drink.
Yeah, that's kind of the question. Yeah,
yeah,
okay. No one tried to force you to have a drink.
Yeah,
yeah, okay. Because if you're a non-drinker now, and I see it myself, people either think you were an alcoholic, there's some other issue going on in your life or whatever. Even now in 2024, you hear people having to explain away the first three reasons why they don't drink.
Yeah.
And for some people, it's their life choice. They never drank. Now, obviously, I think sometimes when I have these conversations, we have to talk about how tough it can be, right? Because
it is.
But very soon afterwards, presumably, you start seeing the benefits of it, and that helps you to stay on the wagon, so to speak. So even in that first tough year, I'd say there's a lot of highs in there whereby you're going, you know what, I've made the right choice here. I can see things changing in my life.
Yes, absolutely. No, there were a great bunch of guys at Stella R&A, and they, at that time, we'd done a lot of stuff together. We went to meetings nearly every night of the week in the early days, and we used to go to conventions out there, and there were unbelievable people that we met that had been at that time sober for maybe up to 20 or 30 years, which in that time was a long, long time. And I never ever felt that I had no friends. These were always very close friends. And our house was one of them houses that they never left. They come at night after meetings and they sat about and drank coffee and smoked cigarettes. There was, I don't know why, how we got away that we hadn't cancer years ago. Some of the rooms you wouldn't have seen the other person beside you would smoke. Yeah. But that's the way it was.
It was the way it was. And at that time, we, you know, as we mentioned on the show last year, we had cigarette companies advertising cigarettes saying the doctor's choice of cigarette and all. It was a different time. We didn't have the information or, you know, and what have you. It was very different. Joe, like, through the course of this and through the 50 years, you've went through some tough stuff.
Yeah.
And one of the... In 1986, it's the toughest year I think anyone could ever go through. I can't imagine in your mind how anything could ever be worse. As much as you're comfortable talking about that, if at all, tell people who don't know what happened in 1986.
Well, we had a fire. Actually, the day of Chernobyl. Chernobyl happened, and maybe a month ago, people would talk about Chernobyl, and we didn't even know what they were talking about.
Yeah.
We had our own Chernobyl, which was... We buried four of our children and a very good friend of ours as well. You know, and they ran from, you know, the youngsters, just two oldest girls and two babies. It was just Noreen O'Donnell and Sharon, Joanne, Adrian and Kevin.
Sharon's just 14, Joanne 12, Adrian 4 and Kevin 18 months. Died in the house fire. It's just...
Saturday morning.
Grace. Unbelievable.
Yeah. Some of those things. Again, I was fortunate I had a... Because from the morning, they arrived and they never left for maybe two years.
So and that support structure,
came
into play in this terrible, terrible loss.
In the terrible time it was. And we were fortunate, you see. And I think my wife, Angela, they coped. They were worrying that I might drink and they forgot about themselves. But I had the structure and I had the program of alcohol to live, you know, a day to day at a time. And I would say, days, you know, it's only today. Maybe it's not real. Tomorrow might be a new day and well, hopefully something better comes tomorrow.
So in a way that should never have happened for a million reasons, the lessons that you learned in terms of sort of dealing with alcoholism and the network that you established were instrumental and vital in helping you cope with the unimaginable. In other words, the day at a time.
We'll see
what tomorrow brings. Today is today. And it's
you know what? It was horrific, and still looking back, it is. There's never a day but you think about them at some stage.
No.
Of your children. Where are they? We believe that they're in heaven, but what would they be like if they lived today? I see friends of theirs that are grown up and married with their, you know, families and that there now. And that's on a regular basis. And
you take that with you. That tragedy is part of you and will be forever.
Part of our life, yeah.
Yeah, okay. And I can imagine the what ifs and the lost opportunities and what have you. But, I think that's very important to recognise and remember Sharon, Joanne, Adrian and Kevin and Noreen, of course, as well. But it just to emphasise, you know, if anything would drive someone to drink, you would imagine it would be that. But the structures were there and the people were there.
People were there.
That were amazing. Isn't that it's an amazing how when we see the worst of things in life, we see the best in people too.
Happened all the time, as we know. Any of the tragedies or anything else that people rise to the plate at, you know, when needed. I mean, we were sitting till 12 and 1 and 2 o'clock in the morning every day. There were always somebody in the house. And the great thing about people to say, oh, you must be exhausted. We were, but we slept. If we were going to bed on our own, it was nobody in the evening. It would be a long night, but we were tired every night. And I think that was part of, you know, the healing process.
Yes.
You know. And people come, I got 9 books that were identical when it was brought by a Jewish rabbi in America. And he had lost a son who at 9 years of age had the old age disease.
Mm-hmm.
And a brilliant book. And he talked, one of the paragraphs of the whole book was dedicated to Irish and the Irish, how they coped with grief better than any other ethnic majority or minority in America. And said this, they had this wake thing. We had a wake for about 2 years.
Yeah.
Every day there was somebody called at some stage.
But how important was that?
You know, it was, that's what it was all about, that building, this, the strength.
Amazing. Exactly. And that's why for some people who lost loved ones through the pandemic, they still, I've spoken to them, I don't know how great they are in number, but they still have not yet really come to terms with it because they didn't get to go through that process that we go through, taking someone home, the wake, the friends, you know what I mean? And there's this,
that is correct.
The moment where they see them in hospital and the next minute they're standing beside a grave and their grieving process is more difficult because they haven't been able to go through the thing.
And I experienced a lot of it. I worked for about 7 or 8 years, I'd done the Good Morning Service, and it was brilliant. And there were one particular lady in Lifford, not going to mention her name, she's dead, God rest her, since that. But her husband died in a nursing home with COVID, and she never even, she wanted all to set the house ready for her to take the home, the coffin, and they couldn't do that, you know. And she, my heart went out to her, and grief for a whole lot more. That time was the same. We were fortunate that we had everything. We had the funeral, we had the, you know, and we had the people come. And for about 2 years, they called.
That's an amazing thing, the two-year wake. It's an amazing way to put it. That really, I can get the sense of the support you were getting in how you described it. It's it is truly amazing. Obviously, there are people then within the AA that sponsor others and are good in supporting others. We don't all have that, you know what I mean? Some of us are receivers and some of us are receivers and givers and some of us are givers. Joe, were you able to use your experience to help many over the years?
There were a lot of people over the years. A lot of people come and just for advice and that there, and went to AA meetings after that, and they were successful. Quite a few of them were still calling and still friends with them, you know. But I wouldn't now be as active as I used to be years ago. But there's still people, the odd one that will still come, or somebody belonging to them will come. And it turned out a lot of times they're successful, that they would go to a meeting and maybe not just raise as fortunate as I was the right away, but they usually get it after a while. It takes, you know.
And I presume you've had contact with people that are a long time off drink and you were probably one of their first port of calls. That must be a lovely feeling as well.
Yeah, it is a lovely feeling, actually. There's a few in Letterkenny that are longer sober than I am.
Yes.
Know? And but it's lovely. It's lovely to know that they're still there, you know.
A number of texts coming in, and this comes in when we have these conversations, is people who have loved ones or people close to them, they know for a fact they're an alcoholic. They know for a fact that, and I'm paraphrasing about 6 or 7 messages here, they know for a fact that they're on a one-way road. You know what I mean? That their health is going to be affected, that they're spending money they don't have. They're worried about, you know, their impact it's going to have on them. And the question that's come in, as I say, 5 or 6 times, and I'm putting them all together sort of in one lump, is how do you help someone like that? You know what I mean? You had that person that came to you, but that person came to you maybe at a time where you were ready for that conversation. How can these people who feel they've got someone in their life who has a problem with alcohol, how can they help them to encourage them to the AA or something?
I think the first thing is, as a bad example, the CEO of drink, and they think, you know, how things have changed. I had absolutely nothing when I stopped drinking. And I'm not well off, but I'm, you know, reasonable.
You're comfortable enough. Yeah.
And they see that you're, you know, things are going well. And a lot of them take a nap, the pay to take, you know, that you're doing okay.
But that's people who come to the AA and maybe have made a decision and sees you an
example.
But
even people before even they come that are still taking a drink.
Okay, I get you.
Some of them will come and say, you'd be enjoying a drink, it would do you the world of good, you know. But normally what they're asking is, what am I doing, or
what's it like off it?
Wrong?
Yeah.
Can we, you know.
But we have a serious problem with drink in this country.
It's absolutely horrendous.
We kind of dress it up as different things.
And it's horrendous, a drinker. You only have to go out at night. And I worked for the last 12 years in working life with Snowdock. And I mean, we were steady on alcohol, and we all know about A&E, and that the drink is the biggest problem. I say 75% of the calls to A&E at the night or the weekend are all drink related.
Yeah. And then, of course, now there's more house drinking.
Oh, yeah.
We kind of transitioned to that.
And, that is the biggest problem, because they don't identify what's going out to a pub and that there, and people don't see them out, and they don't get into as much bother or trouble or out because they're at home. So they don't see the results, or
And you can throw gambling in there and drug use as well. So you're at the stage now whereby you're still involved with the AA, but you don't go there, or you don't necessarily feel you have to go there as often as you might have in the past.
No, we're on it. Funny, I still like to be in touch. If I ever go anywhere on holidays, first thing I do is go to a meeting. And funny, we were on a cruise there last June, and up on the screen, there were three meetings for the week we were away.
Right.
I couldn't believe it. So it was three lovely evenings with different people from all over
the
world.
And do you still at this stage fear that, you know, you can control today, but what if something happened tomorrow and you took a drink? Like, is that still ever present for you, Joe?
No, I never even think about it. Yeah. I drink, you know. And people say, do you want to have a drink? Or no, I don't drink.
Just but you happen to touch base with the meetings and thing on the cruise.
I like the people.
Yeah.
You know, but I'd lovely. I couldn't believe it on the ship that it was with meetings and all.
Great, isn't it?
So we're away again this year.
Very good. Where are you going this year? Can you tell us?
We're leaving Barcelona and Mediterranean.
Yeah, I don't know if Donald's in, but you don't want to get chatting to him, or the two of you will spend the rest of the day talking about cruises and the newsroom. Yeah, he loves his cruises.
I must say, enjoyed it. Reluctantly, I went and thoroughly enjoyed it. And I'm looking forward to this year as well.
Fantastic stuff, Joe. Well, listen, it's like anything, like when we talk about these things, and I've said it before, we only really need to maybe reach one person today that they go, you know, I can do it if Joe 90 can do it. That's the reason we do it, don't we? And that's the reason why you do it. So I really do appreciate you calling up, and I hope you enjoy the cruise and the rest of 24.
Hopefully.
And we'll chat again. But Joe 90, Joe O'Donnell, thank you so much for joining us. Is there anything you want to say before we wrap up, or are you happy enough?
No, I'm happy. I just finish up at that stage.
All right. Thanks so much, Joe. We'll be back shortly.
The county's number one talk show, the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio.
Okay, we're joined by Kieran Sheehan now, who's director of Corcraigan Mill Holiday Limited. And unfortunately, a closure notice has been issued in relation to Corcraigan Gourmet Fish and Chips. Kieran, I'm sorry that you've had to make this announcement. Thank you for joining us. And I think important to help the public understand why businesses like yours, and there seems to be dozens a day, are having to make this decision.
Yes, good morning, Greg, and thank you for your time. It wasn't an easy call, to be honest. We have run Corcraigan Fish and Chips at our wider Corcraigan Holiday business for the last 5 years. We took the tough decision to close this year, just the food side of the business, based on a number of issues, the rising costs, the cost of materials, the pressures, I suppose many, many things, lack of genuine support. And unfortunately, as you say, we're not alone. I was talking to our oil supplier yesterday. He noted that there was about 50 businesses closed in the month of November. There's about 10 a week food-led hospitality businesses closing in Ireland. And I think what's particularly sad is the fact that the hardest hit areas are areas like Donegal along the west coast of Ireland. And the majority of businesses, small owner-led hospitality and food businesses, are really struggling with the rising costs.
Is it a particular challenge for seasonal businesses?
It absolutely is. And I suppose in some respects, people look at the map of Ireland. The hardest hit businesses are the ones in more rural areas. And you have a half a fighting chance if you're working all year round. It's particularly hard for seasonal businesses. You have a very small window of opportunity. And every year you have to gear up, get a new team in place. And you have a very small window of opportunity. And particularly a business like ours, like we are in the cusp of the Wild Atlantic Way. We have seen, big improvements in some respects in tourism numbers and so on. But in all reality, a lot of people are finding, expenditure tough at the moment, and have been, particularly since COVID. It has been particularly hard since COVID to get people back into the hospitality sector, a sector which when you see who's kind of left run it, it's a sector which is kind of high risk, low reward. And it's typically undertaken by owner-operators who run hospitality businesses for the love of it. You know, many battle through year on year. But I think with the increase in costs in particular, we just find this year it's just going to be too much.
And Kieran, without sort of asking anything personal about business or how you operate the business, is it a case that you look at the numbers and there's just not enough money in it? There's no money in it that you'd have to sort of operate at a loss, or perhaps the profits wouldn't, it's not worth the effort? Like, what's the tipping point when you have to make such a tough call like this?
Okay. Well, if you look, generally speaking, a food hospitality business in Ireland will make typically fairly low margins. And I would say about somewhere between 4 and 8% in a good year. And the higher end of that tend to be more for fast food outlets and coffee outlets and so on. It has become a very tough and difficult business. If you consider, for example, our raw materials, our fish, we get fantastic fish from Kelly Beggs. That's up 50% a case. Mm. Our rapeseed oil, where we fry using a really fantastic rapeseed oil, is up 60%. Mm-hmm. Our vegetables are up 60%. Our batter, we use a fantastic gluten-free batter, 100%. I mean, these are costs that just put it out of all
proportion. You can't put that onto the client, because they would look at the price that you would need and go, are you having a laugh?
And that is the challenge. And I think that is the sad thing. We do not want to be sitting. We serve restaurant quality food, you know, at our site at Kirkcaldy Mill, and it does get great reviews. And you can see the feedback we get, and the feedback, particularly since we decided to close, has been really heartening. I must say that. Mm. But you cannot. I could not, in good faith, say to somebody, you know, for an outdoor dining experience, even in the lovely area we're in, it's £19 or €19 for a fish supper. We just can't do it. And there's a level at which you wouldn't expect the public to pay for it. So it's a huge challenge. And we were kind of half expecting more support, you know, from government around things like VAT and various other things. That hasn't happened. And sadly, you know, unless there's a real focus on a fundamental change in how food-led hospitality businesses are supported, mm. you know, you do run the risk right across the west of Ireland of being left with, you know, pizzas and takeaways.
What worries me too is the people that have the power not grasping the urgency. Like, there is some kite flying talk about possibly, potentially decoupling bars and restaurants from hotels in terms of the 9% VAT reduction. But we're in February now, and I'll tell you, we're not far off the middle of February. If anyone's going to make a decision like that, they need to be flagging it now, because there are businesses, and particularly the higher end stuff, that are saying, look, it's not worth it, because for the quality of food that we want to produce, there's not money in it or the clientele to pay for it. So if anyone's going to make any decisions about helping the industry out, you can't kite fly on it. You need to be announcing that stuff now.
Greg, I'll go further. I think they should have been announced 2 years ago or 3 years ago.
I think
the response from COVID has been pretty abysmal, to be blunt. But it's not just about, I mean, the industry needs to kind of stand alone. We tried our best. We've got good, really good ingredients, you know, a really innovative menu, and all the rest. But you cannot fight against rises of energy costs up 50, 60, 70%. You cannot pass it on to the customer. It's just not there. And the sad thing is, when you look at all of the surveys for tourism in Ireland, people love the authenticity of the Irish hospitality experience. And I think that has been sabotaged by the lack of support and the meaningful support and the recognition, particularly in rural areas. Like, if I was in Dublin, I have a massive footfall. I have a massive tourist trade that I don't necessarily have in North Donegal. And we're all treated in the same playing field. We pay the same VAT. We pay the same corporation tax. We have added running costs. The cost of getting ingredients to us is much higher than other parts of other parts of Ireland. So you're up against it before you start. Mm. And ultimately, I think it's a sad thing. Now, make no mistake, like, we would love to have kept it on. We've a thriving business at Kirkcaldy Mill. We're growing year on year on year, but we just cannot sustain running part of that business at a substantial loss.
But another element to this, though, is, and this is no disrespect to you know, the pizzerias or the takeaways or whatever, where they can increase their margins. But it has to be recognised the importance of the food experience as part of that tourism experience. I mean, we are a tourism destination here. It's one of our biggest employers, one of our biggest generators of revenue for the county. And it's like death by a thousand cuts. If we do see pubs closing, the traditional pubs closing, if we do see, you know, particularly sort of the higher end eateries closing, it does affect the product. And then you say, well, what is left? You know, what's the... So we need, and when I say we, I think we as a county, but also you in a certain industry, need the recognition of the importance as part of a greater picture here. You know, it's not about the handout or anything like that. It's part of the greater picture, the greater offering that we have here in the Northwest and down the West Coast.
Mm-hmm. I agree, and I think I would say as well, if I look at, say, Dunfanaghy as a village, we have fantastic options in Dunfanaghy. The Rusty Oven provides some of the best pizza experiences on the island of Ireland. Arnold's Hotel, which has been there for, you know, goodness knows how long, a family hotel, second generation, fantastic offer. You've got the Strand Bar and Grill in Volcarra, again, a family-run hotel, which is offers a fantastic offering, a lovely new Braai restaurant in Chrysler. So there are other options there. But these are all owner-managers who run their businesses. And, you know, they're not, I don't think they get the return that we all would all want. And the challenge is if they give up or they get tired or they get, you know, year after year of more cost pressure, it has to break somewhere. Mm-hmm. And that is ultimately the challenge. I struggle with... you know, how there has been such a lack of investment. If you go into our village in Dunfanaghy, the heart of that village has been sitting derelict, you know, with the hotel sitting derelict for many, many, many years. You know, there's several parts of that village could be brought back into life, mm-hmm. and really made much more attractive to the tourist offering. You know, you go to beaches, there's not even toilet facilities on the beaches. You know, you're trying to compete at a European level, with a world-class offering, with a world-class landscape, with fantastic businesses like surf clubs and all sorts of amazing businesses. But there's not the infrastructure, or I don't think the government foresight, to really genuinely support them in a meaningful way.
Okay, Kieran, just to finish up, I want to be, we have been clear, but just to be absolutely clear, this is part of an otherwise hugely successful business, so I don't want to do any distract. So just tell us just tell us what's still there, what's the offering and all that kind of stuff, Kieran. This is only the fish and chip shop area of the business.
That's exactly it. And we're proud of the accommodation. So we have a lovely holiday accommodation business just in the outskirts of Dunfanaghy and Volcarra, Kirkcraigan Mill. It's a quality accommodation business, really geared towards families and tourists, particularly in the summer months. And we're very pleased with the things we do. Like last weekend, for example, we had a fantastic wellbeing retreat there. We have obviously very good food offerings and so on as well. We do DIY weddings and a range of different things. So we're very excited about that part of the business. And that'll continue, and we're looking forward to a very busy season. I do think food is just a challenge, and it's a challenge too far for us this year, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But I would actively encourage there's still plenty of good offers.
I was going to say what a list of premises that are providing fantastic quality food. Absolutely. In and around the area, so visitors won't be left wanting. Someone said I paid €22 for fish and chips at the weekend in a restaurant, and it was worth every penny. But you have it's about scale, though. It's how many people are prepared to do that, and how long can it be kept at €22, and so on and so forth. Yeah. But listen, that's one person that doesn't mind paying. All right, Kieran, continued success with everything else, and just one very brief question: would like a further reduction in power costs and a 9% VAT rate tempt you back into the game?
I think it might well do, and right. I think we'll keep an open mind. Okay. We'll keep an open mind. I think it's been very heartening, the positive feedback we've had. It might well do, but I think ultimately, you know, I would love to see genuine support for the wider hospitality, food-led hospitality sector on the West of Ireland. There's a bit of a crisis coming down the track as well, Greg. You know, this VAT warehouse, and we fortunately paid all our VAT, and we're not subject to that, but there are companies coming down that's going to hit them hard now, yep, the next number of months. So it doesn't bode well, you know. No.
Listen, and also to people, let's try and not wait till something's closing or someone's dead before we throw praise and put good publicity all over the place as well.
It's a hard enough sector to stay in, and going back into it, not for the faint hearted, that's for sure. But it is a situation, and I do appreciate the opportunity to chat to you.
No, good. It's good to get clarity. Thanks, Kieran. Kieran Sheehan there, who is the director of the Craigan Mill Holidays Limited, which is the majority, or all of the business is still operating, but they've made the decision, and operating very successfully, they've made the decision that the numbers just don't add up to continue Craigan Gourmet Fish and Chips for this year. Okay, thanks for that. Yeah, I paid €22 for fish and chips at the weekend in a restaurant, and it was worth every penny. Yeah, it is, like, outside of maybe steak and stuff, how many, I think people sort of see 16, 17, 18 euros a main course price. Is it, am I right or wrong? I don't know. When you start going into the 22s, 25s, and you're at family four out, not a lot of people can afford that. One of the issues now is that most of the food can be bought for a fraction of the price and cooked at home, says a listener. I saw a healthy breakfast advertised yesterday, €13. Who can afford that on a regular basis? Another is part of the issue now that people are cooking more at home because they're watching all these videos online, and we've developed a love of cooking at home. Maybe that's part of it as well. But a lot of this is tourism business we're talking of as well. So, you know, it's making the numbers add up when the majority or a large proportion of your clientele might be tourists. I ate in a cafe recently, one egg, one bacon, one sausage and toast. How much? €9. I got the same breakfast in another establishment and it was €6. Why is this? Well, I suppose they set their prices. There'll be tourists coming to Donegal because there are no hotels for them to stay in. Just ask anyone in Ardra. They can't run their festivals because of this. Is there a move away subtly? A move to move people out of hotels? A lot of contracts are coming up for renewal late spring, early summer. I wonder what the story is there. Are these contracts being renewed? Maybe there's people in the hotel industry or have hotels. You can contact us absolutely anonymously. But is there still the same eagerness for the government to renew these contracts and keep people in hotels? If you could give us some insight from within the business. I've heard some stories that perhaps the government's trying to exit the hotel industry, in inverted commas, to accommodate people. But as I say, people out there with much more knowledge than me, let me know. If there was more time spent on the important issues in Buncrana, it wouldn't be playing second fiddle to Ballybuffet. A one-way bridge in the middle of the town, a one-way road through the middle of a housing estate in the town centre, no pedestrian bridges, no swimming pool for 10 years, no national schools, no new secondary schools. Two of the biggest employers in Inishowen sit outside Buncrana yet talking about bringing jobs into Buncrana. I mean, yes, that's it. But plans are afoot, aren't they, for the leisure centre? And there is an awful lot of money being spent into developing the shorefront and into Buncrana. So I'm trying to be a bit optimistic, Oisin. Local councillors might say they've all been flat out working on that. Who's to say? My friend's an alcoholic and was off drink for a couple of years. They've been drinking again and are back almost as bad as ever. They think I don't know they're back drinking. I'm so terrified my friend's going to lose her family, as they've told her if she drinks again, they want nothing to do with her. How can I help my friend get off the drink again and get sober? Can I make her see she's an alcoholic, or is this something she needs to see for herself? And that's a difficult one, because you want to be there for her as well, and you don't want to lose that friendship either. If anyone else has some advice, how can this lady, this fella, get through to the woman who was off drink, they're back drinking again, they fear they're going to lose everything because of their addiction. Rightio, next on the programme, we are joined by Fito. Good morning to you.
Hello, good morning, Greg.
Thank you for joining us. Okay, you wanted to share your experience of a scam to try and help others to avoid falling into this. With about 4 minutes, if that's okay. Can you explain what happened to you?
Well, the whole scam took about 2 hours, but I tried to explain it in 4 minutes. I was called on Thursday morning quite early, and there was a man who says he was from Visa in Dublin. And he says that my debit card with the bank was debited for €200 and for €1,100 in Poland. if I knew about this. I said, no, not at all. He said, well, I was afraid so. So we managed to cancel the 200 debit, but the 1100 is more a problem because I left the country. Well, he asked me a few questions, and then he put me through to another man who introduced himself as the head of security of the Bank of Ireland. His name was Bruce Walters, he said. And he also asked me a couple of questions, and meanwhile he said he was sorting things out. And then he says, yes, well, I know what happens. There was a transfer in Western Union in Poland. So, but it's more than 1,000 euros, so they should have sent you a message. I said, well, I didn't receive anything. So he asked me to check my phone, and there was no message, not at all, no text message or whatever. So he says, well, then Western Union made a mistake. So they have to pay you back. And he says, they have to call you. And shortly afterwards, when this so-called head of security was still on the phone, I got a phone call on my mobile, and that was a woman with a very strong Polish accent, and she said she was from Western Union. And she says, well, there was a man called himself James Bertick, and he says he was my son. And he came to the Western Union in Poland, and he says that I allowed him to take 1,100 euros from my account. And I said, well, that's quite simple. I don't have any son, so that's how hostile is impossible. But she said that her story was true, and they couldn't do anything about it.
And can I ask why the focus on Poland? Do you have connections with Poland, or was just
no,
it was just a random country they picked as being the epicenter of this scam?
I think that's the only reason, because I've never even been to Poland, and I don't know anyone there.
So you've got Bruce on one phone, you've got Monica on the other.
Yeah, and that was a complete mess because Monica said one thing and Bruce said the other thing, so it was a complete chaos. Then Bruce was instructing me what to say to the woman, and the woman said, well, we can't pay you back. Then after some time she made a proposal and she said, well, we can pay you back 300 euros and the rest about 90 days. And at the same time Bruce said, no, you can't agree with us. And he says, well, the Bank of Ireland will start a procedure against Western Union in Poland.
Wow.
And then the whole situation seems to change because she says, well, if Bank of Ireland does so, I'm going to lose my job. And really, we have to try to find a solution. And have to think of my point. And I became quite angry. So I was emotional, which is not the best state of mind to think. Well, Bruce asked for a conference call, so that was the three of us on one line. And the woman says, well, I have to ask my manager. And then she came back and she says, well, the situation is very bad. If Bank of Ireland starts this procedure, I will lose my job and my manager will lose his job. So we are going to pay you back in full. I said, well, that's all right. And then the two of them started a very complicated story about banking traditions and different
So just to move it on, and I wish I'd spoken to you a little earlier, Bruce and Monica are both scammers playing good cop, bad cop.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly right. What they did.
And eventually then, I'm sorry, I know the scam went on and I wish I had more time, but I don't. You eventually rang your bank and realised that there was no issue with the account. But at this point... go ahead.
I'm almost at the end of the story. they said it was necessary to make over to my account 2,000 euros that I had to pay back 900. And then Bruce said, yes, well, but he blocked your account because there was a scam. He says, but we can do it like this. There's an app. And then I can see what you are doing on your phone. And then there's a second app, and that's for the money transfer. And at that moment, I felt it was a complete scam.
Wow.
So I said, are you from the bank? He said, yeah, of course. And I said, well, I don't believe you. And then he hung up.
Wow.
But I've been with them on the phone for about 1.5 or 2 hours. And it drives you completely insane. I mean, when I wrote this all up later on, I realized that I could have seen this before.